So what I'm going to talk about is the physics of shocks, and in particular collision of shocks. The introduction will be very brief and very straightforward. We do see collision of shocks. We see them in supernova remnants and in GRBs. There are two key things there. Number one, if we see it, it is there. In the collisionless plasmas, it's not really obvious how you can transport momentum from the downstream to upstream in the absence of collisions. And the only explanation for that would be the presence of electromagnetic fields. And I will show that it is the presence of magnetic fields that actually mediates that and is responsible for the formation of the shock. And number two, we see them because they emit radiation. Everybody knows that we have jump condition. If we have a shock, we can relate the energy density in magnetic fields and the energy density in particles to the total kinetic energy in terms of epsilon E and epsilon B parameters. Crank everything into the theory. You got synchrotron emission, which explains pretty well everything except a few things which I will discuss later. One of them is sharp spectra at soft at low energies. This is speculative. There is no much that was speculative like 5 years ago, probably. It is more solid now. But like I said, these two issues need to be clarified and put on a firm theoretical basis, or at least scientific basis. If you cannot really make theory, you do simulations and you can get those numbers out of there. In terms of energetic electrons, I will not comment here. Maybe Matt Baring will tell that in his talk. I will talk about magnetic fields. The microphysics is trivial in the sense that a shock is an obstacle. And a shock is propagating into the medium. So if you're in the front of a shock, you see the external medium coming towards you. This brick wall, which is a shock, reflects particle backwards, back into the upstream region. So near the shock, you have two-stream motion of particles, and that is the required, well, of course, it's unescapable, and the presence of those components which have different velocities result in the formation of, it results in an instability and ultimately in the formation of magnetic fields there. Yep. Which one? Oh, it's a cartoon. Don't pay much attention to it. General description. Well, we have free energy. And free energy comes from the differences between the parallel and perpendicular energies that particles have. This anisotropy, and the parallel means in the direction of the shock motion, perpendicular means in the plane of the shock. The ratio of those, actual difference in the ratio to the total energy, gives you the anisotropy factor, which is related to the Mach number of a shock. And for strong shocks, that's of order unity. Without going into much details of plasma physics here, just give you the idea. The growth rate is proportional to this anisotropy. The field scale is 1 over the anisotropy. And the field strength is really an anisotropy parameter again, which is the free energy that we have, the difference between the bulk motion and, so to say, thermal motion, times some efficiency factor, which is difficult to estimate from theoretical first principles, but easy to deduce from numerical simulations. What is the instability that I'm talking about? There's a simulation done by Fredrickson et al. It's a very nice movie, and I think it elucidating the major things that we have here. A shock is sitting here. Interstellar medium comes from the left to the right, and you see how magnetic fields are produced. Well, it's proton density, but everything is actually scaling to the density, because proton density is related to the currents, and currents produce magnetic fields, so everything is everything looks pretty much the same way. So the current filaments form, those current filaments produce magnetic field around them. How the current filaments form? Well, again, that's been discussed a lot in the literature. I'm not going to give a solid explanation here. Instead of that, that's the ejecta. This part is the interstellar medium. Here's where the shock is forming. The reflected particles are over here. And that's actually quite a large spread, so the particles reflected, let me run it again. Particles got isotropized and reflected in the regions where the field is strong. So they reflected backwards here, and that's where you see the formation of the current filaments. When the magnetic field and density become filamentary, that's the region where you have two-stream motion of particles. No, it's in this simulation, it's intersecting streams. There's been numerous simulations, and we've done it as well. We don't have that nice movie with the piston moving into the medium, and you see the formation of a shock. So we have just one shock, and the piston makes really physical sense as a contact discontinuity. The same thing, but in the plane of a shock. So what you will see here is the magnetic fields and currents, currents by current, magnetic fields by arrows, and that's the plane of a shock. So you're sitting in a particular place and see how the shock is moving through your place and goes ahead, and you see what is then in the downstream. First you see nothing, then you see formation of current filaments, those bright regions, and magnetic fields associated with them. What happens then is a nonlinear stage of the viable instability, and it results in coalescences. A lot of dynamics is here in terms of motion of current filaments, their coalescences, and that type of things. Important for us, and I will come to that later on. It is crucial in a sense that the nonlinear dynamics results it affects the survival, long-term survival of those small-scale fields. If you didn't quite get from the formulas that I've shown what the typical scale, it's C over omega plasma, which is centimeters. So it's an important thing to demonstrate that the field, that small scale, still survives. What is shown here is gamma ray burst simulation with gamma factor of 10. We're very proud that we've been able to do a realistic simulation for supernova type case. This is non-relativistic, and we put the velocity down to 0.1 c. It's enormously difficult to do in peak simulations, because there are other effects that you have to resolve over here. There are other instabilities that are actually faster than Weibull instability in the non-relativistic case, because Weibull instability is proportional to the velocity of the shock, whereas there are other, like Langmuir, which is just the plasma frequency. So mismatch in time scales of a factor of 10. And you need to resolve pretty well the spatial structure and run enormously long time. We've run for 5,000 plasma times. So that's enormous simulation, and it does demonstrate that no matter what other instabilities do, Weibull instability is still there. You can have magnetic field generation in supernova shocks, at least in the early times when the shock is mildly relativistic or nearly relativistic, like 0.1C, as in this example. And what's shown here is the magnetic field energy density. You see the filament restructure. The projection here is really a projection of the magnetic field, the average field over this dimension. And you see that it pretty well corresponds to what we have in a relativistic case. If we have magnetized or slightly magnetized medium in front of a shock, things can change. For GRBs, it's probably not that important because they need very strong fields to really change the dynamics. In supernovas, it's not that clear. You can have sufficiently large scale, large amplitude fields. And the crucial parameter here is magnetization. Spitkovsky demonstrated by his simulations, but he, I guess he's writing his paper, but it's a result of like a year and a half old and still no paper came out. He's promising anyway. So magnetization parameter is crucial. If it's less than 1% or so, he claims 2%, I would put 1% because it's a nice round figure. There is generation of magnetic field by Weibull instability. If it's larger than that, he doesn't see Weibull instability. It doesn't mean that there is no field amplification at all, and I am looking forward to hear a talk by Wing, and also you can take a look at Misha Malkov and Pat Diamond, poster who describe and discuss the other mechanism that can amplify the field. I will not stop here. On particle acceleration, again, I'm not going to tell much, except I want to point out a very important thing here, that the current filaments are not just currents. These are distributed charges. This is an ion channel, and electrons just move around. They move around, first of all, on the pretty erratic trajectory. These are trajectories of two electrons that you see here. And as they come down, they move in the electrostatic fields of those filaments, and they're accelerated as they move in and decelerated when they move out. So you have substantial amount of energetic electrons down there. To have large efficiency of radiation, you don't need to accelerate the bulk of the particles over here. All you need to accelerate electrons, have accelerated electrons here by electrostatic fields. And since there is magnetic field as well associated with the filament, V cross V force does the work. So you accelerate electrons locally, and they emit irradiation locally. And still you can have non-thermal spectrum because it's a distribution of electric fields and a distribution of magnetic fields. So this whole thing, the effect of running V cross V force, really running acceleration as a function of radius, can create a non-thermal looking like spectrum. On the evolution of magnetic fields, small scales should dissipate pretty fast. So what we've done is we've made extensive numerical simulations of the evolution of fields in the long run and see how the correlation length of the field, and this is the simulation in the plane of the shock. So the shock is really passing you and you're in a downstream region, and the plane is perpendicular to the direction the shock was moving. Those spaghetti-like structures are regions of large, strong magnetic field. And this is electron-positron case. Another one is a realistic mass ratio electron-proton simulation. So magnetic fields are created first by electrons, and at that particularly, around that time, ions kick in and further amplify the field. The important thing here is that this whole thing evolves, and it evolves pretty rapidly. You make a Fourier transform of those images, figure out where the peak of the spectrum is. Here is the plot. Here is the correlation length of the field as a function of time. Nice power law with the index varying from 0.8 to 1.1 depending on whether you're in the relativistic or non-relativistic regime. We've done theoretical analysis of that. Well, actually, not the analysis of this figure. We have pretty good, although simple, a theoretical picture of how the filaments hierarchically merge. And the theoretical analysis gives you power law of 1. Pretty excellent correspondence between the numerical results and the simple toy model that we proposed. Why is it important? Take the fusion equation and substitute d squared by dx squared with 1 over lambda b squared, the characteristic scale of the field. And then plug in the dependence of lambda b as a function of t to the alpha. And we know what alpha is. You can solve that pretty easily. You got that if alpha close to zero, you dump all the field. If all the field dissipates in a finite time. If it's greater than a half, dissipation cannot kill the field. It saturates at some level. And that's what we see in simulations. The field doesn't decay to zero. And the reason for that is that the correlation length is increasing faster than the dissipation kills the field. Science versus nature. In terms of GRBs, we're pretty much simulating GRBs in 2D simulations. 3D is a little off because you're limited by number of particles you can simulate, so if you take a three-dimensional box, you should make it smaller. But it's still not that far. The nonlinear theory that I was just telling about, the coalescence of filaments, goes way into that, and we're pretty sure that at least for the prompt phase, we're really in that regime. This end corresponds to afterglows, and I'm not saying that it's not. Those theories are, and the results are not applicable there, but I just cautiously saying that perhaps more studies are needed to understand the very long-term dynamics of the fields. Radiation. Standard synchrotron radiation says that particles emit when they circle around on Larmor orbits, and they circle around homogeneous magnetic field. In fact, that's not what we have in our case. We have random fields, and you saw two trajectories of electrons. Here is more. Electrons move around pretty randomly. You cannot apply synchrotron theory. No way. The spectrum that you see is determined by the motion, by the accelerations of those particles. So you need to really go with all the particles and see statistics of acceleration that they experience. That's because of the small scale. The scale of the field is smaller than the Larmor radius. And therefore, a particle executes a part of a circle, enter the region with different field orientation, execute another segment of a circle, and it continues. That's what we've analyzed, and that is the paper 5 years old. The crucial parameter here is delta, the ratio of the deflection angle to the beaming 1 over gamma angle, and gamma here is just the relativistic Lorentz factor of an emitting electron. Those two things nicely, I mean, the deflection angle is a fraction of the Larmor scale, so it has gamma in it. Here is 1 over gamma. Gamma cancels out. And you have just the non-relativistic Larmor, lambda over the non-relativistic Larmor radius. This parameter is solely defined by the field strength and the correlation length of the field. It's independent of particle energy. In a simple way, you can do the theory. I won't tell you much about that, except that it's pretty straightforward. You start from Leonard Vickers potentials, plug that in, average over the angles. The key point here is determining the spectrum of acceleration. Now, that can be done pretty rigorously. You know that acceleration is the Lorentz force, so you can relate that V cross B to the statistics of the field. And you got a nice result. The spectrum that you will see, F nu is nu to the 1, whereas synchrotron is softer. It's nu to the 1/3. That argument we used to explain why there is a large number of GRBs that show soft indices inconsistent with synchrotron. That green region is excluded by synchrotron theory. And that's set by the low energy asymptotic of the synchrotron theory. In this new theory, we have a harder asymptotic, so the excluded region is here, and everything looks reasonable now. It still doesn't explain why the peak is at minus 1. There is nothing special in the synchrotron theory or any theory that we had before that says that minus 1 is a specific number. If it's synchrotron, it should be in this unit minus 2/3. If you deal with cool distribution, it's minus 1.5. There are no peaks or there are no features there. And I need to explain it. Why alpha is minus 1? Yeah, one comment. I should make this comment because it's been put on AstroPH, and I've got lots of questions about that. So I want to address that simultaneously to the whole audience. Fleischmann criticized that paper and said that jitter radiation cannot have asymptotic of nu to the 1, except for a special case of ordered fields. That's not really consistent, and his papers actually came out in ABJ. I was one of informal referees, consulting referees on that paper. And I was pointed out that this conclusion that he puts in the discussion isn't really consistent with what he has inside in the general part of his, in the main part of his paper. And if you take a look, you'll see that it's inconsistent. And also, well, it's not difficult to show, and I will show you in a moment that you have that asymptotic under very natural and reasonable conditions. More to say, he claims that his theory explains the range of nu to the 0 to nu to the nu squared. That's not relevant. There's nothing bad about it, but there is. It cannot explain BATSE. No way. Here is the BATSE band. No matter how you move this BATSE range about E peak, and assuming that's, and this is the E peak, the break here is out of the BATSE range. The break which claims nu to the squared is 5 orders of magnitude below. Here's synchrotron cell absorption, and everything should be. And it simply cannot explain it. And finally, I demonstrated before that the magnetic fields are anisotropic. That theory assumes isotropic variation, so it's irrelevant on that ground as well. And finally, is there any difference between jitter and diffusive synchrotron? He himself says that the diffusive synchrotron is 3D jitter. So I think that's clear now. I just wanted to point it out for you, so you will not be misled by different people using the same, different names for the same phenomenon. Now, there is an interesting twist on an anisotropy of radiation that you will see from a shock. You saw that picture, the filaments are in the direction of motion of the shock. As a function of theta, as a function of viewing angle of the shock with respect to the observer, the radiation spectrum will be different. Well, that just tells you the basic formulas, the spectrum, the electron acceleration spectrum that you take. You make the models for them from numerical simulation, so everything is pretty solid here. If you in the angle is theta equals to zero, the shock is coming towards you. It's coming directly towards the observer. That's the steep spectrum, near to the one in F nu. If the shock is moving sideways, then you see near to the zero. For viewing angle somewhere in between, you have the spectrum somewhere in between. If that's E peak, comparing to observations, if that's E peak, let's take a look what the slope at two characteristic energies of 10 times smaller than E peak and 30 times smaller than E peak. Kind of a edge of the Bazzi window. These are two curves. Start from synchrotron violating steep spectra coming down and saturate at zero, which corresponds to alpha to the minus one in flux units that precess you. That can explain even the subclass of tracking GRBs. We know that they exist and there is no explanation to that. But the tracking GRBs are simple in that the flux and the power low energy power low index correlate. How one can explain it? Well, again, toy model, without sophisticated analysis. A relativistic shell that's instantaneously eliminated as a delta function of time. First, you see emission from the on the line of sight patch. So it's Lorentz boosted the most, and the viewing angle is zero. So you see large flux and steep index. As time goes on, you see sideways. As time goes on further, you see the edges of 1 over gamma, where gamma here is the relativistic Lorentz factor of the shell itself. Because of the relativistic aberration in the in its own frame, that's 1 over gamma in the lab frame corresponds to viewing angle of pi over 2. So you naturally have an extended emission with lower flux because of the lower Lorentz boost and softer spectrum. Putting that together in the flux alpha correlation diagram, here is the graph that you saw of alpha as a function of theta. Here is the Lorentz boost as a function of theta in the commoving frame. Well, of course, the slope, here is one of the examples, and the slopes are different for different GRBs, but the simple toy model gives you that correlation and pretty close slope. More to say, just by eye comparison of how many you have the cycle synchronon violating bursts and the bursts which have alphas equal to minus one or close to that, it's 20 to 80. That's pretty comparable to what you have in the Priest catalog of 30% violating and most of them being around minus one, which is the saturation level. And I stop here. You can read by yourself that the summary.
Two questions. One is just an observational question or a clarification that maybe you can help me make sure I understand. Haiti if we take the low energy spectrum of gamma ray burst from for Haiti burst, it seems that the distribution is different from what you showed in pre-Sital. In particular, the quantity of interest is, are there bursts which are below the line of death? Which is to say, they are, the spectrum is steeper than nu 1/3. And it seems that maybe there are very few such bursts seen by Haiti. Could you clarify that
point? Well, actually, we put that discussion in the paper. And the reason for that, as we think, is that Haiti is feeding the entire burst, whereas PRIS does the time-resolved analysis. And that's the key point. You have steep spectrum only during the very, very first moments of the sub-pulse. Everything after that is softer, and if you take the integral integral spectrum, it will be soft. It's dominated by alpha equals minus one type spectrum. So I think the reason here, like I said, is time resolved versus time integrated analysis. If you take the same data that PRIS has analyzed and take not the time resolved but time integrated, you got pretty much the same. You arrive pretty much at the same conclusion that you have very small number of synchronous violating bursts. So I agree with that, and it seems that it's not a problem of the theory. It's a problem of how you extract your data and how you analyze it.
Just a very quick question, an unrelated one. You're saying that the correlation length of the magnetic field downstream is increasing, right? So which means that the jitter frequency will be decreasing downstream from the shock front?
Well, there are subtleties there, and thank you for this question. I didn't have time to really address that. There are several things there. First of all, in electron-proton simulations, we don't really see the formation of a shock itself. What we see is generation of the field, isotropization of electrons, and some response of ions. But ions are not yet isotropized, despite that we run for quite a long time. So it probably means that the thickness of the shock itself is going to be large. That's point number one. Number two, this generation of the field occurs before the main shock compression. So what you would expect is that as this shock compression occurs, the scale length of the field will decrease by a factor of 4 gamma because of the shock compression. That's point number two. So it's not that straightforward to make a conclusion that the jitter frequency will increase. Number three, the structure itself is very anisotropic. And like I said, you have energetic electrons in those current channels mostly. So you shouldn't really take the correlation length of a field as a characteristic scale that you put into your jitter frequency. But you should put a weighted correlation length and weighted by gamma squared of the electron, because the emissivity is proportional to gamma squared. So it's going to be somewhat different. And frankly, I don't know the exact number and the exact trend of the jitter frequency as a function of the distance. But certainly what you say is, in general, it should be right. You start from small scale fields, and the jitter frequency drifts to smaller frequencies because the scale length goes to larger scales. But there are subtleties there, and they need to be investigated carefully.
Other questions? John?
What's the highest energies that the electrons would get to in the ion channels, first part? And the second part is the radiation reaction which they would suffer important?
Well, radiation reaction is really the cooling, what it's called.
But not, cooling of electrons. You only have coherent radiation from these electrons.
It can be coherent. There is one paper on that. I would doubt that it's going to be coherent radiation, because those irregularities pretty strong. I mean, the modification of the current filaments occurs on the light crossing time.
Yeah. No, I mean, by coherent, I mean the equation of motion of the electrons, which you're solving, does not include a radiation reaction term.
Oh, yeah. That's certainly true. And, well, I'm not sure. I don't know exactly how it will change. I don't think that it's going to change the results a lot, because the energy damping into radiation is not going to be faster than the plasma time scale anyway. And everything here occurs on the plasma time scale. But in the long run, it's definitely an issue. So I agree in general, but in terms of the formation in the structure, I don't think that it's going to make a substantial difference. In terms of the electron population, it should limit the maximum Lorentz factor that electrons can get. So again, that's another thing to consider.
I had a quick question with your... You had a slide showing the angle dependence of the spectrum. I mean, that must be in the observer frame, isn't it? Because in the co-moving frame, the electrons are isotropic and the radiation should be isotropic.
Radiation can be isotropic, but the spectral characteristics are still different even in the co-moving frame. On the other hand, like I said, I don't even expect that the electron distribution is going to be isotropic. And the reason for that is that they move in an isotropic electrostatic field. So they preferentially accelerated. And most of the motion of the electron is going to be along the ion channels. So there is a natural anisotropy there, and it's not been investigated by anyone before. We're working on that. We don't have results yet.
Other questions?
Cooling time is exactly the same as the synchrotron cooling time, because it's just the magnetic motion of particles in magnetic fields. Spectrum is different, energetics is the same. Well, I agree precisely with what you say. That's a mystery why we don't see cool distribution in observations. In terms of theory, I can anticipate, at least give you a rough answer to that, that the shock thickness, the region where the fields are strong, is not very large. So you don't really get into the regime of strong cooling. That has problems with the efficiency. Probably one can resolve the efficiency problem by the graph that I shown with the electrons being accelerated locally and therefore emitting locally. So that there is an interplay of this different phenomena.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting point. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.